Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. The airline industry has weathered storms before, but nothing quite like this. COVID-19 has brought business and leisure travel to a halt. Planes grounded, parked at airports across the country. The federal government has come to the rescue with billions of bailout money, but it won't be enough. And there's sure to be more pain ahead as airlines and passengers adjust to a new normal. This hour on Point, coronavirus and the future of air travel. With me from Washington first is Phil LeBeau. He is CNBC's longtime Emmy Award-winning airline and auto correspondent. Phil, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Good morning, Jane, or I should say good afternoon, wherever people may be listening to this today.
That's right. Nice to have you. So, gosh, where do you start? Coronavirus has reset the clock on a decades-long aviation boom, but it is dire now for the airline industry. Give us a sense of how bad it really is, Phil.
Let's just look at the numbers of the people who were screened. And this is both passengers as well as crew members at airports around the country on Thursday. And we'll just pick Thursday. Maybe you could really pick any day over the last several weeks. The decline in passengers compared to a year ago, 93%. About 190,000 people were screened by the TSA on Thursday. Compare that with 2.5 million being screened on the same day a year ago. And yes, that's up a little bit compared to the bottom, which would be roughly April 8th or 9th, when it was down to about 87,000, 88,000. But look, you're talking about a decline of 93%. Even if it's an improvement, a little bit of an improvement, it's still nowhere close to what the airlines need in order to stay in business.
So a 93% drop, I mean, entire fleets grounded. When does that become unsustainable, Phil LeBeau, for an entire industry?
Well, when the airlines get to a point where they cannot bring the cash burn, how much money is going out the door every day, when they can't bring that down to a manageable level. And just for a point of reference, you had some airlines that were burning through $100 million of cash a day, and that's completely unsustainable. And they are improving that because of cutbacks that have been made. But clearly, the lifeline that was thrown to the industry from the federal government, a total of $50 billion, that helps stem the bleeding a little bit, if you will, through September. But let's be clear, they are still losing money on a daily basis. So they need that to come down. And really what they need more than anything else, they need you and I to get back in the air. And there's no telling when that's going to happen.
Right. So talk about that federal bailout, President Trump signing the $50 billion bailout for the airline industry last month. What did that entail? What were the stipulations attached to that money?
Well, it came in two buckets. And the first bucket is what they called payroll grants or assistance for the airlines that was specifically supposed to go for making sure that there were no major layoffs. That was one of the main stipulations. There could be no major layoffs for 6 months. That extends all the way through September 30th. And that $25 billion was divided up amongst the airlines based on a formula based on how many seat miles they have. The largest airlines took out a larger or received a larger portion, in some cases more than $5 billion. Smaller airlines were getting maybe $700-800 million. That's the way it was divided up. Most of that money came in the form of a grant that the airlines will not have to repay. But there was about 30% of the money that each airline received that came in the form of a low interest loan to the Treasury Department that the airlines will have to repay over the course of several years. So that's the one bucket that's already been allocated. There is a second bucket of $25 billion, which is essentially money that the Treasury Department will loan out to airlines as airlines apply for that aid. And several airlines have already said, yes, we will apply for low interest loans that are going to be backed by the Treasury Department. That process is just beginning right now, but you'll see the airlines essentially reaching an agreement with the Treasury Department here over the next several weeks.
For more money? I mean,
for more money.
Yeah.
For more money. You know, and it depends on the airline. Let me give you an example. United Airlines in the first bucket received $5 billion, approximately $5 billion. Now, 70% of that was a grant that they won't have to repay. Mm-hmm. The other 30% is a low interest loan. Now, if United goes back and says, look, we also believe we're going to need more money. All the airlines will need more money. That's not debatable. They will then take a second low interest loan out from the Treasury Department. Mm.
Which airlines came into this pandemic the strongest? And has that even mattered?
It does matter. It matters, and it really matters down the road. If you look at the strongest balance sheets, you'd have to look at clearly Delta and Southwest. They stand out as they've always had very well-managed balance sheets. They're just companies that have done a really, really nice job over the years of making sure that they not only have the liquidity, but also when it comes to things like paying out a dividend or a stock repurchase, those programs were always worked into the idea that you've got to have a strong balance sheet. And they did have strong balance sheets. And so they are in the best shape, or were in the best shape coming into this.
And who was in the worst shape?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. A lot of people say American Airlines probably is in the worst shape because American Airlines has so much debt on the balance sheet. Mm. Remember, American is in the process, or was in the process, of buying scores and scores of new aircraft, updating the fleet over the last 5 years. And as a result, it took out a lot of debt in order to finance a lot of those purchases. And so they went into this with a lot of debt on the balance sheet, and that's there right now. And that debt doesn't get forgiven. So, is American on the verge of collapsing? No, it's not going to collapse tomorrow. But as this crisis gets dragged out, Jane, it becomes more and more of a pressure point for an airline like American.
What about international flights, Phil? What's the status of those flights in and out of the United States?
They're still happening, but at a far lower level than they used to happen. And when you talk with the big three U.S. airlines in terms of their international schedules, they're down to a fraction of what they used to be. Part of that is because of the travel restrictions that were put in place, both with China and then also with Europe. And the other part of it is the European airlines or the Asian airlines, while there may still have some flights coming into the United States, nowhere close to the volume that they used to have. So the international market is widely believed by many in the industry to be one that it's just not going to come back anytime soon. Mm. Nobody expects that the volume to return either on the leisure side or on the corporate side.
Let's hear from Doug Parker right now. He's CEO of American Airlines. He is optimistic that air travel will pick up again when the economy gets going. Here you are, Phil, interviewing him on CNBC.
We aren't seeing people not fly because they're worried about safety on airplanes, I don't believe. There may be some of that. Or the reason people aren't flying is because they're not leaving their homes and because corporations aren't having people come into work. Once those things happen, that's when demand will recover. We'll make certain when demand recovers that our customers feel safe.
People will come into work and then air travel will pick up again. Do you buy that?
I agree 100% with what he's saying. And that's based on not only people I talk with in the industry, also people who I talk with in the leisure and hospitality industry who are not with the airline business, but also anecdotally, Jane. Let me give you an example. I discussed with my wife, hey, would you like to go out and visit some friends in California? And the first thing she said is, well, what will we do when we get there? If we're going to get takeout food and sit in somebody's house, that's not really a vacation. And I don't think that she's alone in feeling that way. And I think there are a lot of people who feel that way. You want to make sure that if you go somewhere, that you'll be able to do what you usually do, whether it's go to a theme park, whether it's golf at a golf resort, whether it's just to enjoy the restaurants and the activities and the shops, whatever it might be, wherever you are going. If you go somewhere and it's not open, there's going to be a part of you that says, why did I do this?
I think
why did I take a trip?
I agree. And I think there are a lot of people who are also nervous about just getting on that airplane, about sitting next to somebody in the next seat who may be coughing up a storm. And that's a real problem for the airlines.
Yeah, it definitely is a problem. And one that they're trying to address by saying, look, you will not be sitting with somebody in the middle seat. We're going to have a little bit more space. Now, they can do that right now, largely because there are so few people flying. I mean, the average flight in the month of April had 17 people on board, which gets into a separate question about the sustainability of the business model if there aren't more people getting on these planes. But I think that does factor into that discussion about whether they're comfortable.
Delta's CEO told his employees that this recovery period could take 2 to 3 years. Phil LeBeau, what do you make of his timetable, and how long do you see before there is significant spike in demand again?
I agree with the timetable. In fact, I think that most people in the airline industry think 2 to 3 to 4 years is really when, and the 4 years is when you want to factor in, maybe that's when we see the international travel coming back, because that'll be the last part that comes back in the opinion of many people. What does it take to get a spike, Jane? I think that it comes down to two things. One, not only do we need to see states and economies and businesses open up so that people, if they're going somewhere, have a reason to go there. People are just not going to buy a ticket just to say, I went on a flight down to Dallas and I turned around and I came back. They want to have a reason to be somewhere or to go somewhere, whether that's business or leisure. So we need the economy to open, different regions to open up. And the other thing that would really make a huge difference would be some form of, if it's not a vaccine, at least it's a way of saying, look, we have some therapeutics that could limit the impact of coronavirus. Because I think right now it's the great unknown for people. And they're saying, how comfortable do I feel that I'm going somewhere and there's not going to be a hotspot? Well, if there is a hotspot, if I know that there is a vaccine or if I know there's a therapeutic and I know that it's just going to be a bad case of the flu, I'd feel a lot more comfortable about traveling.
Listeners, have you flown during this period? What was it like? And what will it take for you to feel comfortable flying again? Phil LeBeau, a CNBC airline and auto industry correspondent, stick with me. We're going to take a break here. We're looking at the airline industry under siege as it tries to bounce back from the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the future of airline industry and what it will take to regain your confidence to fly again. With me this hour, Phil LeBeau, CNBC's airline correspondent. And let me bring in now from Bethesda, Maryland, Sarah Nelson. She's the international president for the Association of Flight Attendants. The AFA represents nearly 50,000 flight attendants at 20 airlines. Sarah Nelson, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
So air travel is down 93%. I mean, thousands of aircraft grounded, 100,000 airline employees, working reduced hours, wondering what the future holds. I'm curious personally how you're feeling in this moment.
Yeah, there's never been anything like this. I've been through a lot of crises, and this just has never been faced before in the airline industry. And I think, you know, obviously we all want to start talking about the airline industry recovering. The fact of the matter is that until the threat is contained, and I'm not talking about having a vaccine necessarily, but until the threat is contained and we have safety procedures in place with the airlines that will help people feel confident to fly again. And as Phil was talking about, that they have somewhere to go and something to go to, we're just not going to see a return. So right now, this is really concerning for us. We still have to go to work as essential workers. So we've got to deal with those safety and health issues. But we also are looking at what's really concerning about our industry that has just collapsed, and no real light at the end of the tunnel yet about when we'll start to turn that corner. So we have federal funding through September 30th to protect our jobs, but we're already looking at what we need to do after that to keep the industry strong and make sure that we don't just have hundreds of thousands of layoffs. Because I'm just going to correct that number really quickly. There's 750,000 workers working for airlines. Over 2 million in airports and airlines alone that were that jobs that are affected here. Mm.
Well, as you mentioned, you are an essential worker. Here's one of the members of your association, a flight attendant named April Rodriguez. She contracted COVID-19 in March. She posted a video from her hospital to an Instagram page. It went viral. Here she is urging fellow flight attendants to stop flying.
I'm asking all my friends, all my flight attendant friends, to stop flying. It's not worth it. Forget your mortgage, forget your bills, stay home.
Forget your mortgage, forget your bills, stay home. Passengers aside, speak to flight attendants, airline attendants. Do you feel safe right now?
Yeah, it's really hard to listen to that, actually. I've heard it a million times, but it's hard to hear it every time. We've had 7 flight attendants die, and we have many who are like April, really struggling here. So we are the most likely to come in contact with the virus next to healthcare workers. So in our job, we have to be sure that the airlines are putting in place safety procedures. What has been hard is that at the beginning of this, we've been dealing with this since the end of December, because, of course, we normally would be flying to every corner of the earth. And we have all kinds of procedures that we have put in place over the years, a checklist for airlines to deal with communicable disease. So we should have crew members who have access to N95 and gowns and gloves and hand sanitizer and sani wipes and other PPE on board. And the fact of the matter is that our healthcare providers on the front lines don't even have that. So that's why we were so loud about saying that the government should be mandating that everyone wear masks, and that we have mandated deep cleaning, and that we have these procedures in place from the door of the airport all through the entire aviation process, and social distancing policies as well. That should be coordinated from the government level. I do want to commend our airlines for listening to us and starting to put some of these things in place. We are feeling better about that. We're not there yet, though. And so we need to use this time to have all the safety and health procedures in place, and also be working with other industries and with our government on working on manufacturing the proper protective gear that we need, both in our hospitals and in places like our airplanes.
You're also on the record, Sarah Nelson, as saying that you worry about flight attendants inadvertently helping to spread the virus. That's
right.
That's the other end of this. Yeah.
That's right. So what was considered under the CARES Act, we had to do a lot of work to help people understand that the aviation industry is actually an essential service for the country. We deliver services and goods to all of our communities that people count on, including medicines. A good portion of U.S. mail is on our planes. And we are moving around essential workers who are going to help fight the virus. There's also a real need for people to travel that's not about going on vacation, but we need to keep those flights open for the people who still need to get around, help their families out, and work together to try to fight this virus. So we have to maintain that essential service, but we shouldn't be doing, we shouldn't have any extra contact right now until this virus is under control, because all that's doing is putting an added burden on our healthcare community and on our government trying to get this under control.
Well, because of the CARES Act, the airlines are not allowed to let anyone go before September 30th. I'm curious, what's your concern after that, Sarah Nelson?
Well, our concern right now is that we put this funding in place and we have airlines like Delta Airlines cutting people's hours. So You know, cutting them back to part time, that affects their benefits, that affects their vacation accrual and sick leave and all of that. So they are not using the money properly now. But unless we have some kind of continued support for the industry after October 1st, this is going to lead to massive layoffs, and it will really be put on the backs of the workers. So we're working now on trying to make sure that that doesn't happen, both in terms of putting in place voluntary programs with our airlines, but also starting to think about what are the kinds of support that we're going to need from our government after October 1st.
Sarah Nelson, thank you so much for your time today. International President for the Association of Flight Attendants, our best to you and all those who are in the skies as essential workers during this time. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for your care.
You can join the conversation, listeners. How do you feel about flying these days? What changes do airlines need to make in order for you to feel comfortable flying again? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Let me get a call in here first from Boston. Eric is on the line. Hi, Eric. You're on the line. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to share my experience recently. Last week, I flew from Cleveland, Ohio to Boston. We live in Boston, my family and I, and we drove out to Ohio to make an escape. It was 12 hours away, and then I had to take care of my father, who was released early from a rehabilitation for obvious reasons. So I was debating whether to drive or to fly, and I have a very good diagnostician friend who said the planes actually are, they're so empty, they're doing a really good job of keeping them clean.
How many people on your flight, Eric?
10. And what was great is is the silver lining. When I arrived to the gate and when I got through security and, you know, in a heartbeat, I got to the gate and I was about 30, 40 minutes early. And the attendant, she was resigned and she just said, well, I guess we're all here. Why don't we just go? And the flight was so fast.
Stress-free.
Stress-free, except for all the people, you could see in the aisles with their eyes wide and their masks tight. Yeah. And then landing in Logan was surreal. It's such a huge airport, and all of these planes, it looks like an airplane graveyard. Mm. And then lastly, I caught a cab thinking, A, I don't want to get on the T. B, Uber and Lyft probably have more people getting in their cars. So I took a cab.
Oh.
And the gentleman who drove me, he said, I haven't had anyone in here for 2 days.
Wow. Eric, thank you very much for the call and that experience. 10 people on your flight from Ohio to Massachusetts. Appreciate that perspective, that color. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now from San Rafael, California. Christine Negroni, she is a former air safety investigator, now aviation journalist, and author of The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. Christine, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So the industry has weathered storms before, but nothing quite like this. How are you viewing this moment?
Well, like everyone else, sort of with my jaw around my knees, it's impossible to get my arms or my brain around the ripple effect of what's going to happen here. I was thinking this morning as I was thinking about being on your program that I did a story for the New York Times about a year or two ago about the biggest Legoland in the world, which is opening up in upstate New York. I promise I'm going to get to the point. This Legoland was opening because there's a small airport called Stewart International Airport, Stewart New York International Airport, that hasn't had international flights. It's $69 Europe to Stewart, to New York. And then there's also one of the largest casinos in America there. Now, those companies, which are somewhat removed from aviation in the conventional mind, are going to fail or are going to come very close to failing because there's no more international flights into Stewart. In fact, there's probably only one or two flights into Stewart now, and who knows how long that will last. Mm. So you think about the knock-on effects, the luxury goods that, you know, are normally sold in airports, the little family mom-and-pop operations that are selling you sodas in the airport, or just, you know, farther and farther on down the line, the things you can't get because flights aren't coming in with products that are produced in other parts of the world and assembled somewhere else. It's monumentally huge. It's earth, It's humanity changing. I know it sounds hyperbolic to say it, but I do believe it's going to change everything about the way we live.
Philippo, jump back in here. You must agree the ripple effect here is pretty astonishing.
Oh, yeah. Christine's spot on. And I've been out to a few airports since this has begun, and it really is amazing when you look at not just within the airports, but the whole ecosystems around airports. So many of them are built up to deal with and to cater to and to work with the traveling public. And it's a little eerie because we're so used to seeing it be so busy around airports that it's not that way anymore. And you have to wonder what's going to happen for these airports as they deal with the loss in business. Inevitably, you're going to have to see state and local governments step up in some fashion. And they already are. I think they realize that while the federal government has earmarked billions for airports, there are so many around the country that are just hurting that they're going to have to do more. And remember, those are big tax generators for state and local governments.
Right, right. So ecosystems completely changing. Christine, what about within the airline industry itself? Are you thinking higher fares, fewer routes, less free food? I mean, what are you anticipating as you look ahead?
I'm thinking that any airline executive who says, as Doug Parker said, that in a few years we'll be back to it and people want to get back on airplanes, it's just a matter of opening up other places, is not seeing this fully. I fear that the aviation industry sees this as another disruption, obviously larger, obviously more perilous, but one they need to get to the other side and they'll be back to business as usual. And I do not believe that. I do not believe we will get back to business as usual in at least the next decade. And I think there's been a fundamental shift in the way people view travel.
The next decade? Is that what you said?
Yes,
10 years absolutely. Out?
I say 10 years before we're back to 2019 levels, if we're back to 2019 levels. And here's why. If you don't mind if I just go on for a little 10-15 seconds on this. And I don't just mean Americans, globally, people have been become addicted to the crack cocaine of getting on cheap flights anywhere they want, anytime they want. That's how the airlines have sold this to the world. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, I love to travel. Most people do. But that's not sustainable anymore, because not just because the finances aren't going to work anymore with social distancing. It's not going to work to fill up an airplane and charge $69 a pop or $120 a pop, but also because we recognize now what the National Security Council said in 2015, which is that airlines are a mechanism for the spread of pandemics. Mm. They said that in 2015, and the airlines did not much about cleaning their own act up. Mm. And so as December and January rolled along and we knew there was this problem in China, airlines continued to transfer people from one end of the earth to the other, and here we are. So that, you know, that how to fix it is very difficult and is not going to get people on airplanes. It's going to keep people off airplanes.
Here's JetBlue CEO Robin Hayes speaking to this point, Christine. Robin Hayes saying, well, confident passengers will soon be comfortable returning to the skies for leisure travel. He spoke with my guest Phil LeBeau last month on CNBC.
I do think there's such a pent-up demand for travel, for people to visit friends and family again, to go on vacation. There'll be some great deals around when this is over. And so for those people that feel ready to take advantage of it, airlines like JetBlue will be there to help them get them on their way.
A pent-up demand to visit family and friends, or a reassessment of airline travel, generally speaking, Phil LeBeau, how do you see it?
I think there's pent-up demand. I have no doubt that there are people who, after 8 weeks, 9 weeks, however long it is that we have generally been cooped up in our homes for the most part, I think people are itching to go and to travel. Now, the flip side of that is that you look at the unemployment report that just came out, 20 million people who are out of a job. I think people might be taking a step back and say, okay, do I want to plan a big expensive vacation? Maybe not. Mm-hmm. But do I want to get away for a weekend with my family or go visit friends? I do think that there is that type of demand there. Whether or not that's enough to sustain a comeback remains to be seen.
Christine Negroni, also a possible reassessment of airline travel generally with remote video conferencing and all the rest that we've been acclimating to over these last many weeks. There could be a general decline, really, as people consider what's essential travel. What's essential really for me when it comes to business?
Exactly. Well, it's business, certainly, because we've learned how to, I work from home. So I've sort of learned this years ago that you can actually do a lot, you know, online and Zoom, of course, and Skype and all of the others, Google Hangouts. My husband works for The New York Times. He hasn't been in the office since March the 13th. So when you can put out a newspaper in the same way, it is eye opening. I do not disagree with Phil that people want to get out of their houses and they want to move on. No question about it. We all do. But I don't know whether he has children or whether but that market is not going to exist for the airlines if you say, which I'm not arguing with the point, but if the word is you're going to have to slap a face mask on for a 3-hour flight, you try doing that with children. That's not going to happen. Try doing that yourself on a flight of longer than 90 minutes wearing a face mask like that. You can't breathe easily. You can't drink your water. You can't. And then, of course, there's how close you're going to be to other people. Mm-hmm. How can an airline possibly make money and keep people socially distanced?
We are discussing how this coronavirus pandemic will change how we fly. Much more after this break, including your calls. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. On Monday, we'll be talking about the surprisingly brief history of hand hygiene. What questions have you had about best washing practices during this pandemic? Have you wondered about the ability of simple soap and water to rinse microbes from your hands, or about the effectiveness of hand sanitizer versus hand washing? We'd love to hear your thoughts and questions. 617-353-0683. Today, we're discussing the future of commercial air travel and the financial viability of the airlines during this time of physical distancing. We're speaking with Phil LeBeau, airline and auto industry correspondent for CNBC, and with aviation journalist Christine Negroni. Let me bring in now from Denver, Barry Biffle, CEO of Frontier Airlines. Barry, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having us on.
So air travel is so essential. It underpins business and tourism and trade and diplomacy and fun. How are you doing? How is Frontier weathering this unprecedented storm in this moment?
Well, it's been tough, as everyone knows, but we have been out front now for a couple months now, whether it be fogging, disinfecting, talking about our HEPA filtration systems, requiring employees to wear a mask, health acknowledgments of passengers. Today we started requiring masks of all passengers, and we just announced last night that we would introduce temperature checks starting June 1st. So we believe that we're doing everything we can to get people safe, and that confidence is starting to translate into more sales. And today, I'm pleased to announce we're booked to over 60%. So it's slowly coming back. I mean, we're not anywhere near. That's on a much much smaller airline, less than 20% of our normal capacity. But people are starting to feel confident, and they're getting out of their shell.
Couple question based on what you just said. You're requiring passengers as of today to wear masks. Do you provide the masks?
No, we don't provide the masks. But in Denver, for example, and in most communities and large airports all over the world, you would have already had to have masks before you even got to the airport. So most of the local ordinances are pushing that. And if we were to provide the mask, the truth is it's too late once you get on board the aircraft. You should have had a mask on before you got to the airport.
And as of June 1st, you said all passengers need to have their temperature taken. I'm reading this as touchless temperature readings. Tell me a little bit about that. What's the high end? What will you not allow a passenger to board with the temperature of?
So the CDC, the WHO, they recommend 100.4 in Fahrenheit as the cutoff. And so we will, like I said, we will have a touchless a thermometer that we check your temperature as you're boarding the plane. It won't take any more time, but it helps ensure that everyone is safe. If you do pop over 100.4, we'll pull you to the side and check it 10 minutes later, just in case you were running through the airport or under some type of stress, to make sure that you truly have some type of infection.
And what if you clock in at a 100.2? Are you still comfortable letting a passenger on the airplane?
That is the cutoff's 100.4. So, and a lot of people have different temperatures. You know, I've checked mine a few times now over the last couple months, and you know, I'm a 97.2 to 97.4. Some people a little bit over, but 100.4 is the what the CDC recommends, and this is what people are using globally. And if you go to Asia, where a lot of travel is coming back now, that is what they're doing to fly on most airlines over there.
So your new cleaning and sanitation protocols for your aircraft post COVID, are you doing fogging disinfectant? Are you wiping down the aircraft every night? You know, what are you doing? And are customers responding positively?
Yes, yes, and yes. So we are wiping down the planes every night, but we're also applying a product that kills the virus on contact. And it actually, we started with a product that kills it up to 10 days. But the new product that we've introduced actually kills it for up to 90 days, but we're continuing to apply it constantly. But again, it's kind of the belt and suspenders approach. We're going through a layering process, and so we're just doing everything we can think of and rolling it out as fast as we can to make sure people are safe. And what we're hearing now is we've kind of reached we've reached the final step, but of what everyone knows and expects. Based on customer data and customer feedback, we're seeing the confidence in travel coming back.
Well, I read Delta Airlines CEO said this recovery period could take 2 to 3 years. Our guest, Christine Negroni, said, oh, nope, much longer. Think more like a decade. What do you have on your mind, Barry Biffle, there at Frontier Airlines?
So, look, I think it's going to be uneven. I don't know. I remember after 9/11 people saying 10 years or ever. You know, the truth is especially in the United States, I mean, our businesses are very resilient and our passengers are very resilient. I mean, once you have a vaccine, that's one thing. The question is how much economic damage we've had between now and then. I think, look, the last thing to come back will be international long-haul travel. People don't want to be stranded like what's happened recently. So that's probably the last segment. I think domestic business travel is probably the next to the last thing to come back. Microsoft Teams and all these other products, Zoom, people have gotten to, you know, used to using it. And if you've got all these businesses that are still telecommuting and working from home, well, they're definitely not going to be traveling. But I'll tell you, we're seeing the majority of the travel right now is visiting friends and relatives. People are cooped up. They're ready to travel, followed by some leisure. But the main thing that we're looking for now, and I think it's too early to prognosticate about whether it's 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, we need to see what's going to happen with the other parts of the travel industry value chain. So, you know, when is Mickey opening up? Is Mickey going to wear a mask? When can we go to Disney? When are the casinos coming up? You know, what are the rental cars doing to make sure is the rental car fogged? You know, is my Uber car fogged? Everyone has to do what the airline industry has done, and there's not a lot of details yet. Some of the hotels are coming up, making some bold moves, but we need everyone to do that, and we also need them to start. I mean, what we're hearing, the number one issue holding people back now, there's huge pent-up demand, but what we're hearing from customers is they don't know when destinations will be open, and they don't know what will be open there. So what attractions, what events, what restaurants, what bars. And so that's what's holding back demand right now, is just lack of awareness of when things will be open. Mm.
So President Trump signed this $50 billion bailout for the airline industry. Do you think more will be needed? Will you need more at Frontier?
So, I don't believe we will, based on what I've seen. But it also depends upon how long this takes. We're slowly opening up the country, and new cases are slowing down, but they haven't stopped. And so my fear, to be quite candid, is if we continue to behave the way we did 3 months ago, as we move back out of our houses and move into public, then you're probably going to see a spike again. Mm-hmm. But these facial coverings are necessary, and it's very real. And I think, I'm hopeful that, people taking that advice, if you can't social distance, please wear a mask. That's one of the main things we've got to do to stop the spread. If this continues to go on, airlines may need more help, but I think the whole economy will. I mean, this just can't continue, 3 to 6 months, or there won't be a lot of it. I'll agree with the comment that it could take 10 years, because the economic destruction will be such that there won't be any demand, because no one will have any money.
Barry Biffle, CEO of Frontier Airlines. Good luck to you, sir, and thanks so much for your time today. We're pulling for you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us on.
Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. A lot of calls here. Let's go to Tampa first. John is on the line. Hi, John. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, this is John. I'm with Vacation Tour and Cruise, a travel agency in Tampa.
Okay, get that in right at the front. All right. How are you doing, John?
I've done this for 33 years. I'm doing okay.
Okay.
A lot better than I am the last couple of times we went through crises.
How are your clients doing? What are they saying to you? Do they want to get on a plane again? Do they want to travel?
There is all kinds of the spectrum. That was kind of why I was calling, as far as that.
Okay.
I've listened to your epidemiologists on some of your shows, especially the last couple of weeks. So we have an 18-month plan. We think they're going to drive first, but we also think that fairly shortly we're going to get to closer by type of trips. I mean, I'm in Tampa, Florida,
mm-hmm.
So we're looking closely at the Caribbean islands, because there's very few cases down there. They have pretty tight public health protocols, having dealt with dengue and Zika mm-hmm. and some of the other things over the years.
So clients driving first, and maybe weekend jaunts after that. That is if they can afford it. John, good luck to you there in your travel agency in Tampa. Jean in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm calling from the perspective of a grandma, and I have two sets of grandsons. One is in Oregon, and the other is in London, England, and so that's 3,000 miles each way. And for me, I'm going to get back on a plane to go see those guys as soon as quarantines are lifted, because at my age and at their ages, they change every day, and I'm not getting any younger. And I feel like any of the time that I can't go see them is time lost to me about their childhoods. And so it's really important for me to be able to do it, and I will be probably bolder than some in terms of just taking the risk to get there and see them.
Jean, thank you. You're a proud grandma, and I understand that, wanting to see grandparents. Barry, Phil LeBeau, jump back in here. I'm curious what you heard in Barry Biffle, the CEO of Frontier Airlines, what you heard in his comments.
Optimism, but all airline CEOs are optimistic that they can make the changes that are necessary in order to convince the public it's safe to fly. We will take care of you. And I think part of this comes down to this whole question, really all of it comes down to the question of confidence.
Yes.
What can be done to give the traveling public confidence, both in terms of going through the airport, getting on a plane, but also when they go somewhere? And as some of the people who have called in have said, is, they believe that people want to go out. But Jane, I keep thinking about this. Do you have the confidence that when you go somewhere, not only can you do what you want to do, but that there's not going to be a flare-up? Because if we start seeing hot pockets jump up all over the place over the next couple of months, that's going to make people think twice before they take a trip.
And Christine Negroni, it's one thing to get on the airplane, as Barry Biffle said. It's another thing when you get to your destination, is the Uber fogged? What about the hotel room? You know, how will I eat? You know, there are lots of sort of ripple effect questions that you have to take into consideration now post-COVID-19.
Yes. You know, and I'd say that the other thing that I think people have gotten a little bit used to where they haven't before, because you have been forced to be in your own, you know, in your own home, in your own community for an extended period of time, is discovering, I think people are discovering their own, you know, their own back doors. I listened to one of your programs recently about the reemergence of wildlife into neighborhoods. So people are sort of, I think, becoming tourists in their own homes and beginning to appreciate that in a way that perhaps they didn't under the onslaught of airline marketing, that you need to go somewhere to be with, you know, to enjoy your family, or you need to go somewhere to enjoy yourself. I think people are going to rediscover their own homes. It's more economical and it's less scary.
Staycations, Phil LeBeau.
Yeah, exactly.
82% of Americans have already changed their travel plans for the next 6 months. And a lot of people, I know, obviously they can't afford it. But to Christine's point, they're staying home. They're doing a staycation instead.
They are doing a staycation. And what also hurts the airlines is the fact that we are in, it may not be a full-blown recession like we saw in 2008, 2009. I mean, it's moved much faster than then. Whether or not it extends as long as back then, I think, is what people are looking to see. But my point is, companies are not paying to put their people out on the road. And they're reassessing, should they put their people out on the road? And I think it's going to take a while for that to come back. I know from talking with friends in corporate America, even the travel warriors, and we all know people who log 150, 200,000 miles because they're always on the road. A lot of those people haven't made a trip in 2 months, 3 months, and are not expecting to do much traveling the rest of this year.
Jim in Sarasota, Florida, has this question. He says, will the airline industry eventually pay taxpayers back for all this bailout money? Phil, what's the answer to that question?
Not on the first pile. Not on all of it. The $25 billion that was allocated to the airlines, 70% of that was a grant, money that does not need to be repaid. So what's that, $17.5 billion? That will never be repaid to the federal government. The remaining $7.5 billion, yes, those are that comes in the form of low-interest loans. And then if the airlines borrow from the other bucket of $25 billion from the Treasury Department, they will pay that money back as well.
Just a couple minutes left here, Christine Negroni. I note with interest that Warren Buffett has sold his multi-billion-dollar position in four of the largest U.S. airlines, American, Southwest, Delta, United. He's always a bellwether for these things. Does it give you pause when Buffett pulls out his investments, and what do you see looking forward?
Well, I am not a business person. I can't speak to that question, but I will say that one of the things that's gone unaddressed when executives like the JetBlue executive we've heard from and the Frontier executive talk about, oh, there's going to be low fares and people will come back, and you know, and all we need is a vaccination, that really does fly in the face of facts. It's not just coronavirus. That's our problem now. But the rise in pandemics and the role of airliners in transmitting these pandemic or creating pandemics has not been addressed and won't be addressed without the kinds of changes to the airline business model, which is slam as many people as you can into an airplane and do a fast turnaround. These things are inconsistent with the kind of safety and hygiene that's required to prevent not just corona, but the next pandemic. So that has to be dealt with. That's a clean sheet of paper problem. That is not a let's go back to the way we did it before. But that's just my opinion. And obviously, the airline executives disagree with me.
Phil LeBeau, I'll let you have the last word here. What do you want us to remember about this conversation and where we are right now?
Basically, that's going to take a while. It is going to take a while before we see large numbers of people traveling again. And in terms of, if you're listening and you're saying, is it safe to fly? Look, so few people are on the planes right now, and the protocols that have been put in place, generally speaking, yeah, it's safe to fly. It's just a matter of whether or not you have the confidence to get back out there again.
Well, Phil LeBeau, airline and auto industry correspondent for CNBC. Great to have you today. Good reporting, and appreciate your insights, Phil. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christine Negroni, aviation journalist and former air safety investigator. Christine, thank you for your thoughts and insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Christine. You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.